Welcome to the 20% True Podcast, Season 4, The Stories They Tell, Episode 2, The Legend of Margot. I'm Carolyn Rahaman. Passed cereal to Margot at the table, so she had to reach for it. It was summer. It was 2 in the afternoon, and they had just gotten up, so Margot and her sisters were having breakfast. The girls prided themselves on their cereal creations, with boxes of cornflakes and raisin bran and Cheerios and grape nuts and granola, which they mixed in different ratios to suit each sister's taste. Margot sliced a banana on top, slices so thin she could almost see through them, while Genevieve ignored milk and ate her creation with yogurt. Lydia's was mostly corn pops, with a mix of dried fruit that popped red, louder than the crackle of her settling cereal. Elena had so much piled in her bowl that it formed a heap, the grains at the top crisp and dry, while the grains at the bottom would be damp and floppy by the time she got to them. The girls felt themselves very creative, and the healthiest of eaters. Their father crossed his arms over his chest as he frowned at them from the doorway. "Where did you go last night?" he demanded. The girls continued their breakfast, too knowledgeable about how this conversation would go to bother looking up and letting their breakfast get soggy. Except for Elena, of course, who blinked innocently at their father. "Go? We didn't go anywhere." "If you weren't up all night, why did you sleep all day?" he asked. The questions were always the same, but Elena liked to mix up her answers, the way she mixed up her cereal. "Just because we were up all night doesn't mean we went anywhere," she said. "We stayed up and watched movies. It's summer. Who cares if we sleep all day?" "It's not like we have anywhere to go," Lydia muttered. Of the sisters, she was the most openly bitter about their situation. "It's lazy," their father said. "And you shouldn't be sneaking, carousing with boys, drinking, egging houses." "We don't sneak out," Elena said, always calm, never faltering from their story. "How can we?" asked Lydia. "You lock us in our room." "Why are you assuming we're sneaking out?" Genevieve asked. As an answer, their father threw a pair of shoes onto the table. He threw them so hard that they banged and bounced. One shoe knocked into the grape nuts box, sending it toppling. Its contents thankfully clipped closed inside. The other shoe skidded to a halt in front of Margot, jostling her bowl and sending drops of milk sloshing onto the table. They were Genevieve's shoes. Brown wedges with hemp-like straps, and they had been destroyed. The straps were frayed and snapped, the sole at the toe worn almost completely through. The heel was thick enough that it had survived, but the bottom was scuffed with grime in black and gray and glitter pink, and the thin cushion for her foot had peeled loose, flapping like the tongue of a panting dog. "How do you explain that?" their father asked, triumph dripping from his voice. Just as it did every morning when he picked one of the girls' ruined shoes and waved it in front of them, as if their response would change. Genevieve blinked at them, then blinked up at him, a picture of innocence, and asked, "What happened to my shoes?" "I'm going to find out where you go," he said, "and when I do, there'll be hell to pay." He spun from the kitchen before Elena could voice another placid denial. Started when one of Margot's sisters got a C- in algebra, and then another sister came home drunk. She wasn't all that drunk, just giggly and stumbly, but their father saw these two incidents as not only related, but both sure signs of the girl's inevitable moral decline. Another sister started dating a boy who was no good. He had a leather jacket and a motorcycle. He would skip class without guilt, and he scowled at everyone. But he would also wait in the parking lot with Margot. Her junior high got out half an hour before the high school, and she sat on the hood of her sister's car and waited. And he sat on the roof of her sister's car and waited too. And they waited together. And he scowled at anyone who might question her being there. And it was a little less lonely. Almost nice. He was always kind to Margot, and, more importantly, he was always kind to her sister, who desperately needed someone to cling to, and someone who would scowl at the world for her so she didn't have to. But their father didn't care. He forbade boys from all the sisters. The sisters got around this by going on group outings, which involved a boyfriend and a third person, who would go see a completely different movie. Often that third person was Margot. This worked until Margot was spotted on her own getting popcorn by a neighbor mom, who reported it to her father. No one spoke to Margot after that for a very long time. When their father found one of their sister's cute underwear left in a cranny in the dryer, he grilled her about who she was dating until her confusion turned to anger, and her anger resulted in all the girls getting grounded for her unladylike language. He then banned allowances so they could buy no more skimpy accessories, and the girls were only allowed to shop for clothes if he was present and approved of their choices. The sisters stopped buying clothes, their appearance deteriorating in protest. Then Margot hit a growth spurt, and with bony wrists gaping from her sleeves, she caved. No one spoke to Margot for a very long time. Then things got bad. One sister got a flat tire while driving in a part of town where she wasn't supposed to be. She would have gotten away with it, if not for how AAA are apparently snitches. This was behavior unlike her. She used to be so open about her plans, offering to take Margot along or sending text updates of the weird things she and her friends saw, sending Margot pictures she would think were funny. But recently, when their father found out, he took their car keys and banned them from driving and chauffeured them to and from school. One sister came home from a study session smelling like weed, which a friend of hers incorrectly informed her could be covered completely with this one special kind of perfume. This was behavior unlike her. She never would have partaken before the stress and the loneliness, the distrust and the bitterness and the rebellion ate at her. But recently, when their father found out, he banned the girls from activities where he could not be present to monitor them. If he was busy, they could not go. He called the school about chaperoning field trips and basketball games. He didn't always follow through, but the threat that he could, that he might, hung over the girls. He followed them to their friends' birthday parties until the girls stopped going to birthday parties. He sat at the table with their study groups until the girls stopped studying, and then there was a resurgence of the bad algebra grades. Margot had never gone to a party more intense than an all-girl junior high slumber party where they drank too much ginger ale, so she didn't know what she was missing. She had it easier, or so her sisters told her, scorn tightening around their eyes. When he found condoms in one sister's purse, boys were double banned, and bags were searched without warning, upending them and spilling out Margot's gel pens and past notes and Pop-Tart wrappers that she hadn't thrown away. Her sister's upturned bags revealed permission slips with their father's forged signature, rejection letters from out-of-state internships, and keys to a friend's car that they'd been using. When he caught one sister sneaking out at night, he moved all the girls together into one bedroom, hoping they would keep an eye on each other, hoping they would keep each other in line. After all, if one sister got caught, all the sisters were punished. Or maybe he was hoping Margot would rat them out. Her sisters were sure she would, and both threatened her and started feeding her misinformation. When another sister was caught sneaking out, he installed bars on the bedroom window and a deadbolt on the door. By the time Margot was 15, the rules for teenage daughters were set. Her father had all the evidence he needed that she, like her sisters, was unladylike and rebellious and headed for trouble. She was not going to get a chance to be well-behaved, because she was sure to misuse it. Sure to fall to the lure of vandalism or ODing or getting arrested or getting pregnant. She was a prisoner. She was not trusted. And she had no friends but her sisters, who desperately wanted to fly apart, even as they were bound together. Thank you. posters were strewn around the living room, draped over chairs and the sofa and the carpet like stretched out cats. They'd run out of reading material and turned to their dad's collection of sci-fi mass-market paperbacks from his office. Not their first choice, but it was literally better than nothing. The sisters read them to make a statement that they were so denied of life's basic pleasures that they had to resort to reading trash. They read them to emphasize to Margot how awful their options were. But for Margot, once you got over the first hurdle of embarrassment at the cover art, the story swept her away. The reading selection was all Margot's fault, because she was the reason they no longer had library privileges. She checked out a mythology book with naked Perseus on the front, speaking of poor cover art. And not only was she dumb enough to bring the book home, but she was too dumb to hide it properly or wrap it in a decoy cover. They had the decoy cover for a reason. So Margot's carelessness had led to this, and it was her own fault that everyone was pissed with her. "Why is Margot giving us the silent treatment?" Lydia asked. Her head rested on one arm of a lounge chair, her legs dangling over the other arm. Lydia had announced that she was not speaking to Margot, which was fine, because Margot wasn't speaking at all. Every time she opened her mouth, she made the situation worse. She thoughtlessly revealed secrets to their father. She dug her hole deeper with her sisters. She added on a new punishment or extended a punishment already in place. She was scared to talk now. Her sisters were right. She was careless. She was selfish. She deserved their scorn. Maybe silence would give her time to meditate on how to be a better sister. Of course, having taken the vow of silence, she could not explain her intentions to her sisters. Maybe that was a mistake. "She's mad that we're mad at her," Elena said. This wasn't true at all, but she couldn't see any way to defend herself. There wasn't anything she could say that would explain to her sisters what she felt, what she intended. Words failed her so often. "I think it's one of those, I'm not going to talk to anyone until they talk to me first things," Lydia said. Heat rose in Margot's cheeks so fast that she saw spots. "No," Genevieve said. "I think it's, if everyone gets mad every time I talk, I'll just not talk at all." Lydia laughed. It was so embarrassingly close to the truth, but said with such condescension. Margot swallowed and kept her eyes on her book. "Is that right, Margot?" Elena asked. Margot tried to think through the heat that burned not just through her cheeks, but her forehead and the back of her neck. She tried to arrange her thoughts, tried to explain in a way they would understand. She took a breath and paused. Took a breath and paused. "Once upon a time, there were six princes who were turned into swans by their evil stepmother." Her sister sighed, and Margot's face flamed hotter, but she kept speaking, her voice only wobbling a little bit. "But when she turned the princes into swans, she didn't notice the princess, who hid because she was so frightened. The swans flew away and the stepmother cackled and left. The next day, the princess set out to find her swan brothers and help them. When she found them, they blew on each other so their feathers blew off and they took off their swan skins and once again they looked like boys. And they were so glad to see their sister, but so sad at the same time because they were turned into swans and they could only be human for 15 minutes every day. And she wanted to help, but they told her that she couldn't. The way to help them was too hard. She had to sew them shirts made of purple flowers, and she couldn't speak or laugh for 6 years, or the flowers would all fall apart, and she would have to start over. So she climbed a tree in the forest and set to work on shirts made of flowers, until a king passed and saw her there, and he..." "Never mind," Lydia interrupted. It was better when she wasn't talking. "Margot," Genevieve said, "that's enough." Margot tried to stay still and silent, to let the room settle back around her. She tried for a solid 5 seconds, but the embarrassment was too much for her. She left with her book and hid in the room she was locked in each night. Margot hesitated at the door to her father's study. Every now and then he'd glance up and she'd scurry away. Then she'd come back to loiter in the doorway, dragging her finger along the frame. Finally, her father sighed and tossed down his pen, looking straight at her. Is there something you need? She shrugged, averting her eyes to the big spider plant on his windowsill. It's okay, he said. You can tell me. His eyes sparkled. She could tell him, but then she'd be punished, and so would her sisters. She closed the door behind her and pulled up a chair to the side of the desk. There she sat, chewing her lower lip. She didn't look at him. Margot, he coaxed. Is this about where you and your sisters go every night? She nodded, still chewing her lip, and he sat back, folding his arms over his chest. I want to tell you, she said, but you can't interrupt. You have to let me tell the whole thing. She glanced up at him. I promise, he said. Then he mimed locking his lips shut and smiled encouragingly, as if she were 5 years old. She wondered, not for the first time, how he could at the same time baby her and assume she wanted to fool around with a boy and drive a car off the road. Both adult problems, if you asked Margot. But they were the same thing. Both thoughts were assumptions that she couldn't make her own decisions, that she should be coddled for her own benefit. She swallowed. Her palms were sweaty. She was sure he would interrupt her, scoff at her story and send her away, announcing later that he was taking away the internet or breakfast or sunshine because she was a liar and snuck out at night. If he interrupted her, she wasn't sure if she would be able to finish her story. And if she didn't finish her story, there was no point in starting it. She worried she would cause more harm than good. But then again, her sisters already hated her for being a goody-goody. They already expected her to tell their father. Why not embrace their expectations? Tell me, he said, already breaking his promise to stay silent. She had visions of her story, told so well it would soften his heart with empathy. It would remind him of the way he used to look at his daughters, before the press of raising them alone splintered him. Her story would make a difference. She had to at least try. So she told him her story. Like always, Margot and her sisters waited until their dad locked them in the room with a click so much louder than a deadbolt should be. They waited for the news in the living room to turn off and for his footsteps to pass by their door. They waited until the water turned off in the bathroom and the lights turned off in the hallway and the shuffling sounds of their father fell silent. Then they waited an hour more. Then the music came. They could hear it through the cracks in the floorboards. Too quiet to make out, but with enough presence to make itself known. It made Margot a bit drowsy. Her shoulders relaxed when she heard it. Her movements turned fluid. Her sisters got ready, dressing in their cutest dresses, their shiniest tops. They laced up new shoes or shoes they had cobbled back together with super glue and staples and needle and thread. They put up their hair and did one another's makeup. Then Elena clapped her hands together three times, and a secret door slid open on the floor between her bed and Lydia's. Wait, just listen. The floor slid open, and Elena smiled. The old smile she used to have. She gave Lydia a hand since Lydia's heels were so tall, and the stairs had no handrail. She adjusted a stray hair near Genevieve's temple, so she looked perfect. Then she smiled at Margot and squeezed her arm. Come on, she said. Elena took care of them, looked out for them. The stairs led to the storm cellar. Their storm cellar was like every other storm cellar for the first 10 feet, a concrete box filled with shelves of emergency supplies and canned goods. It was like every other storm cellar any time Margot went down there, except for when the music crept along the walls. When the music was there, the cellar kept going, forming a tunnel, lit first by naked bulbs placed every few paces or so into the ceiling, strung together with a single naked wire. The walls faded from bare concrete to bare stone, jagged and glistening, then luminescing, turquoise moss creeping up the walls, twinkling lights like fireflies shining in the cracks. Soon the electric lights were gone, although no one could remember when they vanished. As they walked, the floor lit beneath their feet, a burst of blue light that left a footprint, that lingered long enough for Margot to see the triangle shoe and tiny dot of Lydia's footprints, but not of Elena's. As they walked, the music grew stronger. The tunnel expanded into a grove of trees like geodes, erupting from the ground, branching into delicate silver leaves that tinkled in the wind that didn't brush the girls' faces. It reminded Margot of how Elena had described the homecoming dance, the sheets of silver sequins, and the rainbow lights off the disco ball circling the gym. The cave led out into another, this one of trees twisting like veins of gold, as if gold had melted, dripped and flowed into rock that had then been eaten away. Leaves hung in autumn-colored topaz and garnet that covered the ground as well as the branches. It reminded Margot of the Fall Festival, where she had won the cakewalk 3 years ago and never been allowed to return. They'd had a corn maze and a rinky-dink Ferris wheel. She could almost smell the kettle corn. The next cave held a grove of steel trees covered in a frost of uncut diamonds. It reminded Margot of how she and her friends used to have snowball fights after the first big snow, how they would shriek and run and tackle each other, how they would drop snow down the back of each other's coats, and patiently, over the course of careful hours, form the walls of forts. No one had called her last year to ask her to come out for the snowball fight. They all knew she couldn't come. The temperature dropped with the perpetual winter, clouds of breath blooming before the girls' faces. They shivered in their party dresses, but kept walking to keep warm. When they left the final grove, they came to the greatest cave of all, one so large they could have been outside. The ceiling above them was pitch black and shone with twinkling stars, and before them stretched a vast black lake with water like a mirror. Across the lake was the glorious facade of the castle, bright white and gold and lit up for a party. Fireworks popped across the sky, reflecting red and blue and gold in the water, reflected in a dull shimmer in the cave ceiling. The music was stronger, as was the smell of food, and they could tell from this distance that it was more than just one song playing, more than one buffet. The girls waited on the dock, a full wooden dock strung with flags and twinkle lights, and they watched the fireworks until the reflections on the water rippled in the wake of boats, one for each sister. Each sister had a boat, and each boat had a punter, tassels and bells hanging from their long poles. Margot's boat bumped against the dock, and her punter stepped a foot onto the planks to hold the craft still. He held out his hand to help her into the boat, and a smile was lit by a golden firework. Margot had only spoken to her sisters and her father for the past 4 days. 4 days ago, Miss Templeton from down the street had waved at Margot as she checked the mail, and asked her about Genevieve, who used to cat-sit. Before that, Margot couldn't remember the last time she spoke to someone who wasn't family, unless you counted her giving unsolicited advice to people on TV. Or unless you counted the people she met by the underground lake. Margot swiveled around from her seat in the boat to face the punter, far more interested in speaking to him than looking at the beautiful magical castle. She was desperate for company of someone who wasn't sick of her. She was desperate for new stories, because her sisters had as little to talk about as Margot did. The punter, though, he ferried all sorts of people across the Black Mirror Lake, and he collected their stories, just for her, presenting them each night like a bracelet strung with pearls. He transported a dignitary with pointed shoes and a pencil-thin mustache, who could speak 12 languages but loved Spanish best. He transported a firework technician with a crate of explosives and burn marks on his fingers, and a gleam in his eyes as he told of the night's new display in the shape of a blooming rose. He transported a woman in a sleek black dress and long velvet cloak, her head covered by a hood and her eyes covered by shadow. A woman who, after some cajoling, for Margot needed her stories, had admitted that she had come to fulfill a blood feud. He transported a magical rabbit who sat in the prow of the ship, ears perked and nose twitching, then had tipped the punter at the far dock with 5 golden safety pins, each of which would grant a wish. He transported a dancer in a tutu of thick, curling ribbons, who had come to perform but desperately wanted to study poetry. She'd recited a poem for the punter, and the punter recited it for Margot, and Margot felt she knew herself better when it was done, but couldn't remember a single word of the poem, and had no words to articulate what she had discovered about herself. "Are you all right?" the punter asked. She couldn't remember the last time someone asked her that. "Yes," she said. And as they docked before the marvelous castle, she realized that she meant it. She smiled at the boy, and he smiled back. Margot was glad to reach the dock by the castle. This dock, a web of boardwalks, with the spaces between them filled with boats from every corner of the world and every corner of imagination. There were tall ships with three masts flying royal flags, sleek white yachts lit up with electric lights, pontoons propelled by great caged fans, riverboats with tremendous wheels and sunflowers falling from every deck, boats with triangular sails that folded like accordions and were lit with paper lanterns, and the bronze telescope of a submarine, the only evidence of the craft beneath the surface. All manner of people flowed up the steps to the castle and into its marble halls, its rooms smelling of fennel, and sofas soft as velvet, and fruity drinks and canapés carried around on silver trays. A marching band passed through the rooms, circling about twice a night, their songs flowing perfectly into the tunes of each room's music. The zithers and bells, the string quartets and the DJs, the singers with voices like chocolate, and the wall of chimes that urged her to dance and dance and dance. And there were the friends she'd met at the castle, bonded with night after night of dancing and eating and witty conversation. There were the pair of girls from Toronto who had followed their own tunnel through their own groves and together made a violin duo, so they talked about music and had calluses on the tips of the fingers of their left hands. They danced, slapping their hands together with Margot's, circling each other, spinning past another canapé and another glass of cocoa with a tower of whipped cream, and another band with a beat so strong she was jumping, bouncing, a fist in the air as she shouted along with words she knew by heart in the moment, but would never remember in the daylight. And everyone was shout singing with her, together, the music making them one. And yet she could hear no one, for the beat was so strong, and her heart pounded so hard, and her feet bounced without end. Back by the buffet, the Canadians tried to talk Margot into picking up the viola, but she laughed them off for the 8th night in a row. "I would be awful," she said. "There's no way I'm dedicated enough to practice every day. I'd get bored or frustrated and give up." But she was not really sure she would. That wasn't the real reason she couldn't take up an instrument. The Canadians knew she was hiding something, but they didn't push. Everyone here was hiding something, pretending life was more perfect than it was. Together, they cheered as an acrobat twirled down from the ceiling on a thick ribbon, hovering just over their heads so glitter from her eyelashes rained down on them. Then she wrapped herself back up, up, and away. In the green room, where all the food was spicy, was a married couple who were defying age. Their English was accented and their turns of phrase poetic. And Margot didn't know if it was a translation issue, if their native language was full of metaphors, or if it was just the couple brimming with poetry. Eventually, she was going to work up the courage to ask. Maybe in a few more nights. The food here was from their homeland, and they tasted each offering on the buffet, pastry crunching around their lips, humming around the flavor, then espousing upon its virtues. The perfect harmony of mint and paprika, the perfect cook on the lamb, the perfect pocket in the pita. They held out samples to show Margot what they meant, explaining how and why each piece was made, how they were traditional to serve visitors, or made for wedding feasts, how they were cooked in oil the size of a dime and flipped when the sizzle reached a certain pitch. "Close your eyes," the woman said, then placed a delicacy on Margot's palm. "Eat it in a single bite. Take your time chewing, then tell me what you feel."
"What I taste?"
"No, what you feel." Margot did. It tasted of chocolate that crunched and gave into a creamy center spiced with flavors that the couple had taught her. It felt like she was expanding, like her mind had opened a door to reveal a room she never knew was there. It felt like freedom. She felt powerful. As she finished, a taste lingered, one of a fruity liqueur that she tried to identify. Maybe a berry she had never heard of. It hovered on her tongue. She opened her eyes to the couple's expectant faces, and the feeling dissipated. Her cheeks flooded with embarrassment.
"It tastes like chocolate," she said.
The woman huffed, but handed her a speared sausage. "Try this one next." There was a boy she saw around. Wait, listen. He circled the castle just like she did, so it was hard to know where she would find him, but she always did. He was about her age, maybe a little younger, and over the weeks, he had gotten taller. It's not that he was growing, but that he had been so curled in on himself when she first met him, and he was straightening out now, like a sunflower sprout uncurling toward the sun. When they found each other, it was always at a perfect time to take a break in the dancing, to get a glass of water flavored with lime, and find a place to stand out of the warm crush of bodies, a place where Margot could fan herself. They headed to a balcony draped in morning glories that opened not when the sun rose, but when a person was near, breathing and warm. She and the boy liked to come to this balcony to watch the fireworks. "There's supposed to be a new one tonight," she said. "It's supposed to look like a blooming flower." "Nothing will beat the churning river from last week," he said. She agreed that there was little chance a flower opening would beat that display, but she had faith that one day the technician would outdo himself. They watched the sky. "How is today?" she asked. She asked it quietly. In the castle, it felt like you couldn't talk about your life outside, but the balconies were different. The air was thinner, like the sky was getting in. "It was bad," he said. And that was all he said. She didn't know much about him, but she knew his life was worse than hers. Under the burst of a red firework, she could make out a web of scars that ran across his face, swelling shut one of his eyes. He didn't give details, but he had come a long way. When they'd first met, he hadn't spoken at all. The light petered out, and his skin was clear once more. She took his arm and hooked it. "How about you?" he asked. She shrugged. "My sister isn't speaking to me. Not even ask me to pass the cereal. She won't even look at me. She's pretending I don't exist, and I'm starting to feel like maybe I don't." He threaded their fingers together and squeezed, holding tight, offering sympathy and a shield for the next day. "Stay strong." They could both stay strong. A rosebud lit in the sky, shifting from white to pink to orange to gold as it flared open, drenching the lake in falling embers like glitter, drenching the cave in the smell of roses. Every balcony cheered, and the boys smiled as they headed back to the party and were swept away from each other. And the dream swept her through the castle and through the night until the sun was about to rise, and suddenly she was on the castle steps, catching sight of her sisters, all of them flushed from a magical night, all of them rejuvenated, all of them on tender feet, carrying shoes worn to pieces. Lydia threw an arm over Margot's shoulders, pretending to use her as a crutch. Genevieve joined hands with her, and they swung them back and forth wildly. She laughed and told her that she had met a mathematician lady who had explained factoring over a tray of candies, and then they danced to a polka together. Elena noticed that Margot was shivering as they waited on the dock, and offered her her scarf. They all laughed because the scarf would do nothing to keep anyone warm. As they crossed the lake, the punter lifted an eyebrow at her, expecting a story, and she was not surprised to find that she had one to share. And the whole trek back, across the lake and through the glades and through the tunnel and into the house where the sun had yet to rise, Margot's blood was still singing. Her father stared at her for a long time after she'd finished. He'd finally stopped trying to interrupt her. And maybe she should be glad of that. She should be glad he was finally listening to one of his daughters, instead of making assumptions without explanations. She should be glad that she was finally able to express herself, to get a full story, the full extent of her feelings, out of her body and into the air. But instead, the longer he stared at her unspeaking, the more she worried that she'd made a horrible mistake. She shifted in her seat, her hands digging into the kangaroo pocket of her sweatshirt, her eyes darting around the office, to the holes on the bookshelf where the missing paperback books once sat, to the paperwork on her father's desk, work that she'd interrupted, to the window to the front yard, where maybe there would be a car accident that would distract her dad enough that she could slink away. Finally, he sighed. "Margot..." He stopped, cutting off whatever he was going to say, then starting again. "I guess you really haven't done anything this summer except read mass market paperbacks and watch soap operas." She shook her head,
not trusting herself to speak anymore. She didn't want to push it by correcting him that they weren't technically soap operas. "When was the last time you left the house?" he asked. "I get the paper every morning." He nodded slowly. "And then you curl up in the window seat and read it front to back." She nodded again. "Would it..." He swallowed. "Would it help if you could get some fresh air? Some exercise?" She stared at him for too long, then nodded way too fast, way too many times. "Would it help if you could talk to someone?" Her neck hurt how fast she nodded, how tense she'd been holding it. Her father took a deep breath. "I'm worried about you, Margot." Her nodding slowed. Her isolation and solitude were worrisome, yes. But this seemed a strange thing to say, or a strange way to say it. Like he was coming at the problem from slightly the wrong angle. Like the blame for her woes lay on her own shoulders. The twisting in her gut that she'd told her story wrong, that she shouldn't have spoken, intensified. "I'll make an appointment for you to see someone you can talk to. Someone who could help you? Would you like that?" He smiled hopefully. She blinked at him. Then it hit her. "You think I've gone crazy."
No, sweetheart. Not at all."
She stared at him until he continued.
"It's just... you do know you and your sisters don't actually..."
He made an incomprehensible gesture with his hands and trailed off, maybe hoping she'd finish his sentence for him. When she didn't, he cleared his throat. "I mean, I hear what you're saying, Margot, about feeling confined, about needing an escape. And I see that you've found that escape. I'm just... I don't think it's healthy." Margot frowned. The ball called to people who needed an escape. It gave them somewhere to go. Somewhere to be someone different. Someone with different problems. Was it really unhealthy? It seemed the healthiest part of her life.
"And you really haven't done anything wrong," her father said. "Not like your sisters. I really have been treating you unfairly, punishing you for their mistakes. It didn't make sense to have different rules for each of you."
He tried again with a hopeful smile.
"I thought it would be like giving you preferential treatment, but I see now that I was really punishing you for things you never did. Should we try again? Adjust the rules a bit?"
She kept frowning.
"Yes, they should try again. Yes, they should adjust the rules, but then again..."
He was coming at the problem from an uncomfortable angle. She could see where this would go. The restrictions would be dropped for her, and not for her sisters. And her sisters would hate her more. She would look like the favorite, the baby, the tattletale. Preferential treatment. She couldn't delude herself enough to think that he'd drop all the restrictions anyway. He'd only dropped them because he thought she had issues. Just enough for maybe supervised morning jogs or weekly trips to a therapist. What she wouldn't give for weekly morning jogs and weekly trips to a therapist. It was a reprieve, a blessing. It was a thimble of water when she was dying in the desert. She wanted to jump for it, despite the inevitable fallout with her sisters, despite how measly of an offering it was. She'd spent hours planning exactly what she would say, but now he'd thrown her so off track that she had to change course. She had to take the risk. She took her hands out of her pockets and flattened them against the arms of her chair.
"That's not fair," she said. "We all feel this way. We all go to the castle, even though I'm the only one who remembers it. You've been treating us like a unit for so long. Why would you stop now? Why just punish me with fresh air and exercise?"
"Margot," her dad sighed.
"No, listen, I'm not crazy. I do go to an underground fairyland every night, and I do dance in a castle. I do."
"No, you don't." She shot up, out of her chair, startling her father. Her throat was tight and her face was hot. It was such a gamble.
"Maybe I am crazy. I'm crazy for thinking you'd believe me, that you'd listen."
He glared and stood himself, so he was once again taller than her. "I'm going to get you help, and you're going to go whether you like it or not.
You're punishing me because I'm the only one who would tell you. You've been asking us to tell you for weeks, and I'm the only one who did, and now I'm the only one who gets sent to therapy. I'm the only one who has to exercise. That's not fair."
He threw his arms in the air. "Fine, then you'll all go." She thrust out her hand to shake on it. He boggled at her, but couldn't seem to catch up before taking her hand. His handshake was uncertain. Hers was hard, desperate. Before he could say anything more, before he could take it back, she twirled from the room. Her sisters were in the hallway, gaping at her, betrayed. They'd been listening in, at least since the shouting started.
"What have you done?" Lena breathed.
Margot grinned. "I got us fresh air, and someone who'll listen to how we're being mistreated." Her sisters stared. Margot pushed past them, back to the bedroom, shutting the door behind her before quietly opening her sock drawer. She wrestled some things out of her kangaroo pocket, a crystal stick of a tree branch, the silver leaves tinkling as her fingers brushed over them, a gold branch, and one with diamond leaves. She picked fuzz off them and buried them deep in her socks. She had a small fortune there. She had proof. She'd meant to show it. But that wasn't the story that would get her what she wanted, what she needed. She buried the branches deeper and shut the drawer. The 20% True podcast is written and produced by me, Carolyn Rahaman. Music is composed by Kamiku. If you like the show and want to help new people find it, you can rate and review on iTunes. Visit the website, 20percenttrue.blogspot.com, for updates, thoughts on writing, and book reviews, and also for additional information about the 12 Dancing Princesses. Follow the show on Facebook at 20percenttrue.facebook.com, or follow me on Twitter at Carrie and the Hits.